Welcome to another episode of the Mile End Institute podcast. Today, we're delighted to welcome Simon Cooper, journalist and author, whose latest book is called Chums, How a Tiny Cast of Oxford Tories Took Over the UK. And it's that book that we're going to be talking about today. Welcome, Simon.
Good morning.
Now, your book kicks off with a very striking, bold claim, namely that if Johnson, Gove, Hannan, Dominic Cummings and Rees-Mogg had received rejection letters from Oxford aged 17, we would probably never have had Brexit. Could you unpack that claim for our listeners?
Yeah, I should have probably unpacked it a bit more in that paragraph. But what I mean is that Oxford is the fastest route to political power in the UK. And these guys were on the escalator to power, and they knew it from the age of 18 because of Oxford. Now, if they hadn't got into Oxford, if they'd gone to another university, they would very likely never have achieved their later positions of power. And the Brexit project originates in large part in Oxford, in that boarding school caste at Oxford. So, yes, I think the whole thing doesn't happen if these men don't all come to Oxford, where many of them know each other, and take it from there.
So many people will wonder, particularly those who are kind of familiar with British higher education and who don't necessarily actually live in the UK themselves, because these places have got such a reputation. What is it about Oxford as opposed to that other elite institution, Cambridge University? What is it, you know, about the one rather than the other?
I mean, they both have historically taken in a very large cohort of public schoolboys who were kind of born into the hereditary elite and perpetuated it. But the difference between Oxford and Cambridge when it comes to politics is the Oxford Union Debating Society is a lot more prestigious than its Cambridge equivalent. And so if you're an ambitious 17-year-old politico, especially from that particular boarding school caste, and you want to be prime minister one day, you're much more likely to want to go to Oxford and start climbing the rungs of the Oxford Union, where you'll meet a lot of other people like you who are rivals, friends, and later part of your network when you all go up to Westminster together. So the Oxford Union is decisive. It's produced several prime ministers, including, of course, Boris Johnson. And a smaller element in this is Oxford has the PPE degree, politics, philosophy, economics. Cambridge doesn't. And the PPE degree also attracts a certain kind of politicos looking for, let's say, a superficial amount of the cutting-edge knowledge required to run a modern country. So think of David Cameron, Rishi Sunak, Harold Wilson in the past who did PPE. That's another Oxford-Cambridge difference.
Hmm. And actually, you go on to talk later on in the book about the disadvantages of PPE in that sense, in the sense that many of the people running the country have a, if you like, a smattering of knowledge about economics and a little knowledge being a dangerous thing. And you suggest perhaps that lack of, if you like, quantitative or analytical skill does actually make a difference to public policy. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really blame only PPE. I think that having a three-year undergraduate degree, which at Oxford is 24 weeks of term a year, so a bit under half the year, so you add it all up and, you know, you add on a few weeks where people come up a bit early, the beginning of term, you get to about a year and a half of formal education post-school. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's a tiny amount. So any degree you're going to do in that time is going to be superficial. PPE just more so, because you're doing three completely different subjects. And the other thing is that, you know, you mentioned the lack of grounding in science, maths, economics. I mean, that was kind of inbuilt much more in the 80s when these men were produced, 80s and early 90s, than it is now. But still a big problem of Oxford, and I think British education generally, is the skewing towards art subjects. So the leading Brexiteers, the people I discuss in this book, they mostly did history, classics, or English lit for Gove, which is mostly the canon. So backward-looking subjects, which of course are fine and intellectually interesting. But then when you get into cabinet and you face issues like climate change, nuclear energy, COVID, how do we assess exponential growth of a virus? Well, their educations had not prepared them for any of that. And often these people, you know, the way the British system works, you drop maths and all science subjects at the age of 16 for crying out loud. So I would see it as a very poor way to select a governing class.
Hmm. And you also take it a little bit further when you talk about the Oxford Union and what's required to make a good speech at the Union, and indeed what's required perhaps to write a good essay in an arts or humanities subject. You talk about the fact that, well, facts, and in some ways, maths is seen as detail and is seen as boring. And this word boring is, you know, absolutely what has to be avoided at all costs by these people who then enter what you call the rhetoric sector of the economy.
Yeah, I mean, it struck me over the years in my limited dealings with the upper class that boring is a kind of core upper class word. And in the Oxford Union, the ethic is very much, it's about entertainment. It's about being funny and witty and having these kind of saber-like attacks on your opponent, or you just ignore the opponent and make an ad hominem joke. Think of and Boris Johnson, who's carried that style fairly intact to Westminster. Think of him during Partygate mocking Keir Starmer as Beer Korma. You know, that kind of joke that sidesteps the argument. So the Oxford Union is very much skewed towards applauding the funny people, and especially the funny men. It's an arena in which women are often not welcome. Even the posh private girls' schools don't teach typically public speaking, rhetoric, in the way that Eton does have a debating society. Women in the Oxford Union will often be judged first on their appearance rather than what they say. And because the chamber is so large, female voices don't carry as well. So the whole thing is set up for a group of men, especially public school men, to kind of be funny. And of course, the master of this kind of empty being funny style was Johnson. Now, American students who'd come to Oxford from the American debating tradition would say, well, 77% of, or 98,000 people have. And those things just didn't go down at all well. I mean, then they would be, the epithet fat would be shouted out as a criticism at them.
Yeah, not many places where that is in fact the case. You also talk, when you talk about the Oxford Union, about the connections that these guys can make, not just with each other, but that is an important thing, but also with other more experienced politicians. For those who aren't familiar with the Oxford Union, could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the networks are crucial and will exceed what anyone else at any other university can assemble. So in 1985, the 18-year-old Michael Gove is campaigning for Boris Johnson to become Oxford Union president. In 1990, Dan Hannan set up the anti-European Oxford Campaign for an Independent Britain, which is joined within a few months by Jacob Rees-Mogg. So these networks are very old and deep. But then, as you say, they also meet the speakers, who often are well-known politicians or other power brokers in London who've come up from London, often to their old university, for an evening of being wined and dined and sleeping in the Randolph Hotel and meeting the students. And so these contacts are very important. Ted Heath actually met Winston Churchill when Heath was an undergraduate at Oxford, and Churchill's mate, Frederick Lindemann, invited a few undergrads to his rooms to hang out with Churchill. I mean, you don't get that at many places as an 18-year-old. And Johnson actually very cunningly used his, when he was president of the Union, his connections with visiting speakers. So he charmed and impressed Max Hastings, Telegraph editor, Charles Moore, future Telegraph editor. And when he sacked from his job at the Times, famously for making up quotes, Max Hastings, who remembers Johnson from that evening at Oxford, immediately gives him a job. So these contacts are just overpowering.
Yes, and you mentioned, of course, that they go from Oxford into what you call, as I've said earlier, the rhetorical sector or the rhetoric sector of the economy. They make their way first, many of these people, as journalists. Do you think, therefore, that in some ways it's the editors, the proprietors, perhaps even sometimes of those newspapers, who are, you know, really crucial in those networks. It's not always actually politicians themselves. It's a kind of indirect entry into politics via journalism.
Yeah, I think that's especially true of the Tory press, which functions as a kind of outrider brigade of the Tory party. So the Daily Telegraph is, it will sometimes criticize the Conservative Party, but it's understood as part of the movement. So if you're an ambitious young man from Oxford, going into the Telegraph is a way of speaking directly to Tory members, Tory MPs, the wider Tory family, making your name there. And then you might easily be referred by a powerful Tory journalist like Charles Moore to someone within the party. So that's the route that Boris Johnson and later Dan Hannan take. I mean, Hannan initially helped set up the European Research Group at Westminster immediately on leaving Oxford, becomes its first employee, but then goes to the Telegraph to write leaders. Johnson, of course, goes there. Gove goes to the Times, where he's adopted by Rupert Murdoch and also becomes sort of part of the wider Tory conversation. So when you then run for MP, you're kind of a celebrity within the Conservative movement because everyone has been reading you all those years.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly resonates with me. And I mean, actually, our own research on party members shows that the Telegraph is, you know, by far the most popular newspaper read by Conservative Party members. And as you say, these people become celebrities and it does give them a huge advantage, both in becoming MPs and, of course, once they have become MPs. And for me, your description of the Tory press there as almost part of the Conservative Party is something that really resonates as well. Now, you also bring up the sort of zeitgeist of the 1990s, the fact that the right's biggest enemy is the Soviet Union, the trade union movement had been defeated while the Conservative Party was drifting back home towards electoral oblivion against Tony Blair. What impact did that have on those impressionable young men? And what made Brussels the ideal new enemy for them?
I mean, I think for their first 10 or 15 maybe 20 years in politics, they're casting around for a project because Thatcher was their heroine, but she's a very rare politician who actually more or less completes her project. You know, she cuts taxes so much over the 11 years, she privatizes so much that by the end, you can't really take tax cutting and privatization much further if you want the UK to remain a recognizable Western country. So it's very hard to take Thatcherism any further, which you see with, you know, John Major. Sort of out of desperation, they then start to privatize rail, which, you know, clearly is not something that was ever a good idea. So there isn't much more you can do. As you say, the USSR is gone, the trade unions are gone. So what is the Tory party for? And then Blair kind of renders the Tories irrelevant for nearly 15 years. And so these guys are casting around for a project. And meanwhile, Dan Hannan, since 1990, has been saying, look, the project is Euroscepticism, which soon evolves into Brexit. The project is Brexit. Gove comes on board that. Johnson, who had never really particularly needed a project, of course, he doesn't really care about policy, eventually in 2016 jumps onto the accelerating Brexit train. And he kind of makes it, you know, brings it all the way. And wins it for them. And so Brexit becomes their generational great project. And it fits sort of their ambitions, which are very big, because they come from this tough caste that has ruled Britain in the years when it was a superpower. Their ancestors, you know, oversaw empire and two world wars. And they wanted something glorious for themselves. And finally, they work out what that glorious thing is going to be.
And you suggest also that, of course, that it doesn't really have too much of a consequence for them because of the backgrounds that they come from. And in fact, the economics of Brexit, you suggest, doesn't really matter to most of these people, possibly Dan Hannan aside. Why is that, do you think? Why are they so unconcerned by the economics of Brexit? Is it this sort of rejection of facts as boring, or is it simply because they're so rich, you know, they can't really lose out anyway?
I mean, I think British politics, if you are one of the practitioners from that public school set, you've never really met anyone who's poor. So it's just not a vivid issue to you. It's not something you care about, lifting people out of poverty. Why would you? You've never seen it. And what you care about is the statues, the greatness, the grandeur of the country. And you also, I think it's very important, is the architecture in which they're raised. You grow up in a kind of shambling old house somewhere in the countryside of southern England. You go to a medieval boarding school, then you go to medieval Oxford, and then you go to the medieval House of Commons. So your whole life is spent in kind of old England, which has survived the centuries. And England, of course, I say England because these people's experience very much is England. England, of course, is protected in a way that continental Europe isn't, by the water. And so nothing very bad happens here, certainly not to the ruling class. And so you think, well, let's do Brexit. It will be fun. It will be glorious. And if it doesn't work out, you know, it's not such a big deal. I mean, I think many of them understood, including Johnson, that maybe it wouldn't work out so well. But what could possibly go wrong in a country where all these medieval structures are still there and surviving? I mean, it's a, you know, Britain, in their caste especially, is a country, they're a generation without tragedy, the most protected generation in a country that for more than 300 years has avoided civil war, revolution, famine, invasion, any really disastrous thing happening on its own territory. And so that breeds complacency. And I think this is a very complacent political generation, not just the politicians, but also the voters. I mean, if you choose as your prime minister someone who, you know, we could all see was not cut out to be prime minister, but who's a funny man, then I think you're saying, well, we don't really care that much about politics. This is not Poland. This is not Germany. This is not a country where people have very deep existential fears about what can go wrong if politics goes wrong.
And you also suggest that there's a, if you like, a damaging degree of deference on the part of the British electorate. In other words, part of the reason that they bought Brexit, as so many people, was because it was offered to them by this elite, which they believed in some ways was born to rule, yes?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's an aspect of Brexit that's an anti-elitist revolt, but it's also led by this elite of public schoolboys. You know, it's a coup by one set of public schoolboys, Johnson's lot against the other, against Cameron's lot. And I think Brexit only wins because it's led by Oxford-educated elite types. Now, imagine if Nigel Farage is the face of Brexit. They couldn't have won. You know, he's not seen as a safe pair of hands, someone who's responsible and knows how to run a country. You know, even Farage's supporters see him as a bit of a lad, a bit of a rabble-rouser. What he needed was people like Gove and Johnson with their Oxford accents, their Oxford credentials. So they're not, Johnson's not just a funny man. He has a classics degree from Oxford, so he must know how to run a country, surely. Who say in these very plausible Oxford tones, well, nobody's talking about threatening our place in the single market. And the day after we vote to leave, we will hold all the cards. So these are people playing responsible politicians, which in the British context, if you're a man with Oxford and a public school accent to your name, then you seem serious. You're understood by the population to be somebody who is born to rule. And I think that born to rule aspect is very significant in the Cameron and Johnson era, that a lot of British voters obviously feel resentment towards public school types and Oxford types, but they also have this feeling, well, yeah, but they know how to run a country, don't they? Someone who looks like Cameron, he sort of looks like a prime minister.
You bring up David Cameron, and that raises one of, I guess, the criticisms that some people have made of the book, which is, you know, you talk about this bunch of people who are educated at Oxford. They all become Brexiteers as well as Conservative MPs. But David Cameron, of course, went to an elite public school, went to Oxford, George Osborne, the same. But of course, they were on the Remain side. So, you know, is that a problem, you think, for your thesis?
Well, I mean, they're all in my book. I mean, I discuss this at great length in the book, that Oxford produced pretty much the whole of today's political elite, including the Labour people. So Keir Starmer leaves Oxford in 1987, the same summer as Boris Johnson. Starmer has done a graduate law degree there. People like Ed Balls, Yvette Cooper, the Miliband brothers, they all staff the Oxford Labour Club. And as you say, the leading remainers are there. So everyone is there, which is part of, you know, what I call the oxocracy, that Britain is run from Oxford by Oxford people. And the oxocracy is, they have different views. So, you know, some of them are willing to jump on the Brexit train, often with misgivings. Others jump on the Remain train, often with misgivings. So, you know, Johnson and Cameron are made by many of the same forces, and Cameron also doesn't like Europe and feel that Brussels is impinging on the kind of public school in Oxford's caste right to rule. So he has a lot of those prejudices. But Cameron is just more of an institutionalist than Johnson, and Johnson also sees personal advantage in going for Brexit. So they're not, it's not a unified group, the oxocracy, like just like the Tory party isn't. But this, and there's also different kinds of Oxfords. So the Oxford of the public school Tories who go through the Oxford Union is very different from the kind of Oxford of state school people who go to the Oxford Labour Club, or people who don't do anything politics at all but just go clubbing or play cricket. So there are many different Oxfords. It's not a unified whole. And the reason my book focuses on the Tory Oxford Union Brexiteer caste is because they won. You know, they're just much more relevant than the Starmer group, or now more relevant than the Cameron Osborne group, because these people are not just ruling the country, but they've also remade the country. So I'm not saying that the whole of Oxford is Tory Brexiteers. Absolutely not. I mean, most Oxford students, as I say in the book, would have voted Remain, not most Oxford graduates. But the Tory Brexiteers are a subgroup within this ecosystem, and they matter because they won.
Now, you do think, don't you, that Britain has a particularly cohesive ruling class, and you think that has to do with the fact that the UK, unlike some other countries, Germany being an obvious example, but you could also look at Spain, Italy, doesn't have these sort of multiple power centres, as you call them. What difference do you think, not only Oxford, but the centrality of London in the UK's cultural and economic life makes to your story?
I mean, I think there's this sort of good chat theory of politics within the British elite, which is well known, the term coined by Peter Hennessy, which says that we sort of all think the other person means reasonably well and is okay. And so, and it's partly because they all went to Oxford and then they all come to London. So their life paths become very similar. So whether it's Tony Blair or Harold Wilson or Ed Miliband or David Cameron or Ted Heath, say, very much people agree to disagree, and they agree on the big things like war and membership of the European Union. So you have a unified establishment. I would say after the Munich rifts heal in the Conservative Party with the outbreak of war, that heals. So from 1939, certainly until the start of Thatcher, most people in both parties agree on the big issues. Thatcher breaks that. She sort of doesn't believe in consensus. But then after Thatcher, the establishment unifies again. So Labour under Blair accepts a lot of the kind of Thatcher legacy. And so then everyone mostly agrees on the big things until 2015, when Jeremy Corbyn, who obviously doesn't agree, becomes Labour leader, and the Tories develop a Brexit movement, which, you know, casts into doubt one of the great points of consensus of all the parties that we're Europeans. And so with the arrival of Johnson and Corbyn simultaneously, the establishment splinters again. So that's a sort of very unusual development in Britain. And so I think a lot of people on one side or the other really think that Johnson is bad. He's a breach. He is shocking. And of course, people on the other side believe the same about Corbyn. Now, I think that the way Britain works is the establishment will unify again, and the new consensus will be, well, we need better links with Europe. We're going to drift into something that looks like the single market. We won't call it that. And both parties will eventually support that. And the Brexiteers will be marginalized. The kind of hard Brexiteers will be marginalized. And and the consensus will also be, well, we can't go into Europe because that's just too controversial. So the tendency of the establishment to unify is also helped by, you know, the fact this country has never had extraordinarily deep rifts within its establishment that you get as a result of a civil war or revolution, say.
So, Simon, your book ends on a rhetorically, anyway, Leninist note. What is to be done, you ask? And your solution seems to be reforming Oxford so it either becomes a graduate-only institution or makes even more fundamental moves towards what admissions tutors like me would call widening participation. But you don't seem to me to be too convinced that either of those things is likely. Have I misinterpreted you? Are you more optimistic that something can change?
I think things are changing, but they need to change more. So Oxford is now majority graduate. I think for the first time in the university's history, they admit more graduates than undergraduates, which is good, because I think there's a kind of greater seriousness at the graduate end, partly because of people's life stage, which is more...
So is that more Keir Starmer's than Boris Johnson's?
Yeah, more Keir Starmer's than Boris Johnson's. And I think that's compatible with, at the same time, doing what I call an Oxbridge for All, where you try and find all over the population, in all ages and social classes, people who didn't go to university the first time around because of where they come from or because their life wasn't in that place, but people who are extremely bright and very motivated to study something. And whether that's for a summer at Oxford or 3 years, Oxford should go out and find them and bring them in and give some of the excellent tutoring that exists in many parts of Oxford to a much wider set of the population than the kind of 18-year-old private school people that Oxford has traditionally educated. Now, Oxford's very proud, and to some degree rightly, that 68% of the intake last year, undergraduate freshers, were state school. And Oxford and Cambridge have this target now of higher state school intake, but the main consequence of that is they go and find the upper middle class state school kids from, you know, leafy suburbs or parts of London where people have bought a £1.2 million home to send the child to, you know, very, very upper middle class comprehensive. And so, although I think it's a step in the right direction, it's not exactly widening access. Now, I've spoken to quite a few Oxford academics, and a couple are sympathetic to it, but most are skeptical and get very defensive at the idea that I suggest in the book that Oxford should stop teaching undergraduates. A phrase they like to use that I've come across is ridiculous.
Yes. Why do they think that?
I think it's hard for me to fully understand. I mean, they certainly lose money on undergraduates, and there's, I think, still issues with undergraduate work ethic. So the undergraduate is given this amazing opportunity to have one-on-one tutorials, but often wasted by not doing serious work. I think it's partly because they do like this power that Oxford has in kind of producing the ruling caste. I think that a lot of people go into academia because they want to teach. Well, can that be true? Do they really want to teach undergraduates, or all academics want to do research?
Well, no, I think some of us do enjoy teaching as well. And you know, sometimes there actually is genuinely a kind of cross-fertilization there. And there's an appeal in some senses in having to explain what you do in terms that an undergraduate can understand, which, you know, possibly helps you communicate it elsewhere. I do wonder, as I say, though, whether, you know, you really do think that some of the suggestions that you make, you know, can fly, or whether you just think, you know, this is going to go on forever. I mean, you know, you make the point right at the end of the book, don't you, about, you know, oh, we could just do nothing and let, you know, this sort of self-perpetuation carry on. Where do you really stand on that, do you think?
I really think a lot of this can happen. I think Oxbridge for All can be done. It can be much more than now. I mean, already they're bringing in promising high school students from disadvantaged places for summer schools at Oxford. So I'm saying let's continue this trend. More graduates, more state school, more summer schools for bright teenagers from poorer parts of Britain. Let's run with the direction we're going in, because all British institutions are under power. I mean, are under pressure from the kind of anti-elitist, anti-entitlement movements we've seen in the last few years. I mean, Brexit had a very strong anti-elitist streak that scared all the British institutions, whether it's Oxbridge or the civil service or the BBC. But so too does Me Too, So too does Black Lives Matter. There's a, I think, a growing feeling that you shouldn't have something just because you were born a certain way. And of course, Oxbridge is all about, has always been until now, all about letting people in because they were born into the right caste.
And finally, I mean, you know, as you say in the book, you know, you yourself are a product of Oxford. Do you think that helped you write the book, or do you think there was any way in which that was a disadvantage in that you were both, as it were, an outsider criticizing some of this, but also an insider?
I think it helped me. I mean, I'm an outsider in the sense that I grew up mostly outside Britain. And, you know, I then, in early adulthood, moved to Paris for most of the last 20 years. I'm currently spending a year in Madrid. So I see Britain very much from the outside, and I see Oxford from the outside. But I think the Oxford in me helped me understand people like Johnson and Hannan and Gove, you know, who are really journalists like me. Because like me, they were trained at university to write and speak for a living, to write kind of plausible essays, which then become called newspaper columns, to, you know, bluff your way through situations where you don't really know very much. And so I deplore their faults and their superficiality. And I deplore it in myself as well. I'm, you know, I am like them in ways that I regret.
So, final question, should we ban journalists from ever becoming MPs?
Good idea, I think, but certainly Telegraph journalists.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll finish this episode of the Mylan Institute podcast. I'd like to thank Simon Cooper for taking the time out to talk to us. As I say, I can highly recommend his thought-provoking book. And of course, I can highly recommend other episodes of the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please do share and review us. And if you'd like to find more about the MEI, our events, our blogs, etc., then you can find us on the web and all the standard social media platforms. So until next time, goodbye.